cards. What about that cool card you just bought?
Oh, yeah. Man.
What'd you buy? You bought some wacky card, right?
I bought a crazy, crazy card. Probably the dumbest thing. Not dumbest, but like most irresponsible use of my money I've ever experienced. I bought a $2 million Magic the Gathering card.
Wow. What kind of market is there for a $2 million? Are you bidding against yourself? Are there other people that are like, I'm in?
He was like, all right, well, Posey said you can get 2.5 for it. So 2.6. But man, I don't know. It's a Lord of the Rings Magic the Gathering collab they did.
Mm.
And there's only one of them.
There's only one card.
Mm-hmm. There's only one of them. So out of all the boosters, all the collector's packs they sold, that was the one. And a guy in Toronto, his name's Brooke, he's an absolute legend. And he worked at Costco, and he went to his local game store, and I don't know exactly how much he wants me to share, but he went to his local game store and pulled it out of a pack, and it was a $2 million card.
Wow.
Isn't that crazy? It literally is like Willy Wonka's
golden ticket.
Yeah, man. It's so cool.
Well, as long as it gives you joy.
Very much so.
I would give that away. If somebody gave me one of those, I'd give it to you. I'd be like, I don't know what to do with this.
I wish you pulled it. I wish you pulled it.
I would have just gave it to you. 100% I would have just gave it to you.
But yeah, I don't know. I love. Have you ever played Magic the Gathering?
No.
Joe Rogan?
No.
You would be a beast.
I don't think I would. It's a card game?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I'm out.
You don't play poker or nothing?
No. I appreciate it. I watched a bunch of people play blackjack in Vegas. Dana White and a bunch of football
players. I love
blackjack. Oh, it's so scary. They were betting so much money. It was terrifying.
Isn't it fun?
Yeah. I enjoy watching. But I have an addictive personality.
Sure.
Particularly when it comes to games.
Sure.
I get very addicted to games. So I have to be very careful because I'm at casinos all the time because I'm at UFC fights. So I'm in Vegas all the time. I cannot be that guy.
Well, Magic's not a gambling game. You don't bet for money. You just play.
Okay.
And it's like, so there's over like, Jamie, would you let me know how many Magic cards? I think there's over 30,000 unique Magic cards right now.
And so you're playing, and how does it work? You get dealt a hand?
No, so you draw from your deck. So if you're playing Commander, it'll be you, me, and then two of our other buddies.
Okay.
Oh, there's 50,000 unique.
49,998 total unique English language Magic cards.
Isn't that crazy? So think about it, and the way that it works, it's like chess. It's just it's a game of nuance, and it's just like, it's the best game ever created.
Really?
Ever created.
Wow.
Yep, in history.
Wow. I don't have time for that game.
No, that's what I said. If you don't have time for Diablo, get into Magic. Will eat your life. It is like, in a good way, I enjoy playing. Like getting together with my buddies, and you just got three of your good friends, four including me, and you're just sitting there smoking, drinking, talking, just like this, but you're also playing like chess with over 50,000 different pieces you can utilize and create whatever the you want with.
Mm.
It's an amazing experience.
Mm. Okay, I see it. I see what you're saying. Obviously, there's a large group of people that believe that as well, that agree with you. I mean, it's a huge game.
It's huge.
Ready to go?
Yep.
Sick. Oh, hello, and welcome to a brand new episode of Lucky Paper Radio. My name is Andy, and I'm here, as always, with my co-host, Anthony. As far as I can tell, only nostalgic for the film The Labyrinth, Maddox.
You think that's the only experience I had in my childhood?
No, you just seem unaffected by nostalgia largely. Like when I think of most people our age, there's a bunch of crap from their childhood that is objectively crap that they still like, me included,
mm-hmm.
for nostalgic reasons.
Sure.
Music, television, video games, art, whatever. I can't think of any examples for you except for the film Labyrinth.
You know, it's funny because I didn't even see the film Labyrinth until, like, high school.
Well, that's embarrassing
for you. Which I don't know if that's, like, when does nostalgia start? But I did love the Muppets. The Muppets were big for me growing up. I don't know.
But the Muppets are actually good, is the thing. So I feel like...
So is the Labyrinth.
No, it's not.
Are you...
Labyrinth is awful.
Okay, you know what? I don't know if I can... I don't know if I can keep doing this.
Labyrinth is the Dragon Ball Z of movies.
That is... Dragon Ball Z is the Dragon Ball Z of movies.
No, it's a television series.
I can't. I don't have the energy.
It's just a bunch of people that don't understand David Bowie, and so they're like, oh, he's doing some freaky stuff I don't understand. This must be creative art. It's bad.
When was the last time you saw it?
I've seen it only once with you in college, and it was bad.
Okay, we gotta watch it again. You're doing this to yourself. We got David Bowie, we got Muppets, we got cool little guys, we got a swamp.
Are they actual Muppets? Like, is Jim Henson involved?
I think so.
Or is it knockoff Muppets? Because the vibe is not the Muppets vibe. It's got puppets, but it doesn't have Muppet energy. And what I like about the Muppets is good. Muppets is genuinely good.
That's amazing.
Because of the Muppet energy, which I think is completely absent from
directed
the Labyrinth.
Directed by Jim Henson. Says it right here on internet.
Well, he must have been doing a bunch of shrooms or something at that point. What else are you nostalgic for?
All right. You know what? I can't get over it. Writers, listeners, write in and tell Andy that he's wrong about the movie Labyrinth.
I got a bunch of people that wrote in and told me I was objectively correct about the movie Oppenheimer and that it was... In fact, a super long
trailer.
So
you're 50-50. I don't know.
Somebody did email to say they agree with me, but also they think it was an intentional decision because basically the only silence in the whole movie is right before the bomb goes off. Because literally every other moment of silence is punctuated by a bed of music. And to me, it's like, okay, sure, I can see that point, but it's a 3-hour movie. You can't have the whole movie have a bed of music just so you can have one cool bomb scene. I don't know. It seems like a lot.
I don't know. Food, I guess.
You're nostalgic about food?
Yeah.
Okay. But I mean, also, I feel like you actually grew up with good food. I don't trust nostalgia good things.
What do you mean?
I mean, I know
this is another weird opinion. We're just coming out with all kinds of weird opinions. Nostalgia's only... I mean, you're saying it like it is noticeable when it is a contrast, when you like something, not because it is good, but only because you had this experience with it.
Yes.
It can be both.
I know it
People
definitely can be
have
both.
Experienced
it definitely
positive
counts.
Things in the past.
It definitely counts still as, you know... a thing that reminds you of your youth, even if it's a good thing. But anyway, the reason I brought nostalgia, Anthony, is because this episode is the follow-up. I guess not really a follow-up. Last year, we did an episode called The State of the Game 2022, which was basically our reading of and thoughts on Mark Rosewater's annual State of Design article. That was a very popular episode. People really enjoyed our conversation we had last year, and so we're doing it again this year. The State of Design article 2023 came out on July 31st, so we're recording this a few weeks later, and it's basically Mark Rosewater running through all of the releases of the year. Notably, this article does not include Lord of the Rings, which came out around when the article was released, but he had written the article previously, and mostly it's him digesting feedback from fans. I don't think they had any real feedback at that point, so Lord of the Rings is not mentioned. I think we should talk about it regardless, but yeah, it's basically an excuse for us to talk about the state of the game more broadly, which we don't do very often. I think a lot of other podcasts or YouTube channels, they talk about this a lot. It's like their bread and butter is talking about observations and criticism of the game and how it's being managed and run, and we don't really do that much here because we like to kind of just do our own thing over here in the Cube world and just ignore stuff we don't really like.
Yeah, I mean, I think that a lot of people that play Magic engage with the game in a different way than we have in the last couple of years, where they're much more involved in sort of the cycles and what's happening with the game itself. You know, if you're playing Standard, it really matters what they're putting into Standard, when they're banning
things. Do you think a lot of people are playing Standard?
This is just an example. It could also be Commander. Or if you're playing Limited, obviously, like, a big part of the way you engage in your hobby is, like, what Wizards is actively doing, what is the new stuff that's coming out. And we, I think, you know, the last couple of years, at least, have been a little bit removed from that, in that a new set comes out, we're excited to see the new cards, we're excited to grab a couple new things for a cube, but it doesn't necessarily dictate. It isn't like the driving force behind how we're engaging with the game.
Yes.
And I definitely feel that difference reading this, where in the past reading the State of Design, it's like, oh yeah, like I'm curious about how Mark Rosewater sees this other perspective on the experience that I've been having. Whereas now looking at it, I'm a little bit like, oh yeah, that's that set I got like these three cards from, and that's that set I got these three cards from. I haven't really been playing that much Limited except for pre-release, which is still, you know, still one of my favorite events. So it's a different feel for me.
Yeah, I think it really does highlight the underlying incentives of cube design, right? Which to some degree are definitely that we want to like create our own limited environment and all the stuff that's more related to cube itself. But honestly, the other thing about cube for me is that it's a much healthier way for me to engage with this hobby.
Right.
I don't want to be in the tumultuous cycle of what's going on in standard or, you know, some other constructed format. Like we're over here kind of setting our own terms, making our own goals, making our own way to engage with the game on our own terms. We can just ignore a set we don't like. We can just, you know, do whatever we want. And to me, that's like just such a better like mental model for how to engage with this thing, because we've said on the show before, I am not fundamentally like a fan kind of person, right? I don't do like fan culture. I wouldn't call myself like a big fan of Magic the Gathering. I like it as a game, not as a like IP or product.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think more than even just setting your own terms, or, you know, in addition to that, it lets you set your own pace. Again, if you're playing standard, the set comes out, or, you know, you're playing limited, the set comes out, this is what you're doing now. You can't necessarily just be like, I kind of liked the last set, I'm going to keep going to FNM and doing the last set for a couple more weeks.
If you're playing Legacy, you don't get to ignore Orcish Bowmasters.
Exactly.
Or the One Ring.
But with Cube, like, I legitimately did not update my cubes for 6 months, and it's not like we weren't playing a bunch and doing, you know, playing all kinds of cubes, but it was just like, yeah, the way that I wanted to engage with it for a bit was not making a bunch of changes. It was seeing what other people are doing in our community, and that was fine. Like, I wasn't forced into a particular pace. And it's I think it's sort of a weird dichotomy where, in some ways, Cube feels like a much more invested way to play, because you're, like, taking on the
design
challenge.
You have to do all that work.
You're doing a bunch of extra
making
work.
Your own terms.
And, you know, I spend a lot of time, like, doing Scryfall searches and, like, literally building tooling to...
Cube design is difficult. You have to do a lot of Scryfall searches.
You gotta do a lot of Scryfall searches.
You're gonna get really familiar with Scryfall.
But on the other hand, it's also, like, a way that you can participate where you can engage less, if that's what you're looking for. Like, I can take my cube, put it in the cupboard.
Engage selectively. Like,
engage selectively, yeah.
Like, I still spend just so many hours a week thinking about Magic and talking with friends about Magic, but very little of it is the drama around whatever is going on in some constructed or retail limited set or whatever, because that's just not how we're engaged with the game. Which is all by way of saying that we're kind of outsiders in some sense looking in on this article, but I am invested in the overall arc of Magic as a game because I care about it fundamentally. And so even though I'm not in the day-to-day like, oh, I'm like griping about this or complaining about that or whatever, I do care what Mark Rosewater thinks about the state of the game, the future of the game, because on a big scale, it's something I care about and want to continue to exist and be successful. So this is like the one time a year where we kind of, you know, take a look at the game from that perspective.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I've definitely said this before, and I have heard this from many other cube designers, that if they stop printing new cards tomorrow, they could just still enjoy the 27,000 cards themselves and, like, keep building new cubes.
You would still be designing new cubes 10 years later if you wanted to.
I'm not actually sure how true that is, though. Like, the fact that there is this, like, ecosystem that we are still a part of, even if we are in it in a selective way, is really important to the health of our hobby.
It would be, like, near impossible to grow the playgroup further if Magic stopped existing and stop proving out a new product. If, you know, Wizards of the Coast goes bankrupt tomorrow, we all still have all the cards we already have. We could probably still play Cube with the people that we play Cube with pretty regularly, and then slowly that group would, like, dwindle over time. It would be so difficult to grow it at all. We're not going to meet new people that are invested in the game, because we are definitely, like, you know, attached to this bigger thing. And in that way, we're invested in its success. Like, and you could say we're like a little moray eel, you know, sucked onto the bottom of Wizards of the Coast, but it's kind of true.
It is. I mean, and it's sort of an interesting thing. I just love thinking about systems and the way things work. And Magic is a really complicated system, and it works because there are multiple facets working together. Standard in particular, I think, is just one of the coolest design solutions to a real problem. Like, Richard Garfield invented the trading card game. They want to keep printing new cards, but they also don't want to power creep out the old cards and make them meaningless, so they invented this, like, rotating cycling system, and they have all these techniques for increasing power level in some effects while decreasing others so that they can change it in the future and, like, invert those sort of balances to keep it feeling fresh. And I thought that was such a cool design solution, even though I've never played Standard. I was a big limited player for a while. I played Commander for a while. We're playing Cube now, but, like, that part of that ecosystem still really, really mattered because it kept the card designs feeling fresh. It kept things, like, stable and backwards compatible. And I mean, yeah, that's part of what Mark Rosewater has been talking about, especially in the last 2 years, is that, like, that solution of Standard hasn't worked as well because of all kinds of changes in the player base, and they're just sort of trying to navigate new ways of solving the trading card game problem that isn't necessarily a rotating format.
I think we should start with last year's state of design and just kind of recap where Mark was at last year and where we were at last year. I'm actually a little surprised. I think Mark should maybe take a page out of your typical like annual report for a company kind of model, and like you should return to the things you mentioned last year. And in our previous episode about the State of Design 2022 article, we talked a ton about complexity. That was a big subject of that article, and the fact that cars were getting more complex and how to handle that. We also talked a lot about the sort of designing for the eternal world idea, and we mentioned that in that article, Mark Rosar mentioned Commander something like 40 times and other formats almost not at all in the 2022 article. And that also had wrapped up in it these like idea of color pie changes, namely like giving white more card draw and some other related things. So we talked about all that stuff. It's a year later, Anthony. How do you feel about these points? Like, how do you feel about the complexity of the game 1 year on from Mark Rosewater's article saying that they need to be a little bit more conscious of not printing as many complicated cards?
It's interesting that he didn't really address this at all.
Didn't address it at all.
He stepped around it. I guess he did mention a little bit that there were issues with complexity, especially in Unfinity, which was just off the charts in terms of like a bunch of external game mechanics and stuff like that.
Yeah, and his step-by-step breakdowns, there's a couple times where he says like this thing was a little complex, but it is not mentioned overall as like a focus of R&D or like a major thing they're conscious of at this
right.
moment.
I mean, for me as a player, I feel like they kind of didn't change that. They just like have powered forward and continued to make things extremely complex for all kinds of reasons. I guess there's some exceptions, like the Warhammer 40K set had a lot of like interesting, relatively simple designs that were still sort of resonant with the theme. That, I think that set really stood out in a lot of ways. But yeah, I mean, my reaction in a lot of ways has been like, I'm kind of enjoying Cube over here. If a card comes out and it's super wordy, I'm more likely just to opt out of it.
I actually do think I feel that things are a little bit less complicated. I mean, I think it's hard sometimes to like keep a grasp of time. So just to be clear, what we're talking about is the sets Dominar United, Unfinity, The Brothers War, Phyrexia Albi 1, and March of the Machine. That's the sort of ones that are covered by this. And when I think about the really complicated sets in recent years, it's mostly the ones from a couple years ago. It's like Kamigawa Neon Dynasty, Strixhaven. You know, those were the sets where I think like, oh, all the double-faced cards, the cards with a million words
on
it. Yeah,
that's true.
We did a DMU draft last night, and I was remarking to one of my opponents that I really liked it, and it felt a lot like a core set. And it was actually, truthfully, the first time I've ever drafted that set. I played pre-release of it. I never did a single retail draft of DMU. And I think the designs were elegant. They were simple. The kicker mechanic was very simple and well-executed, and a lot of like clean designs that feel like they could have been printed 20 years ago. So I actually do kind of feel like a little bit of the complexity stuff has been quietly addressed, even though Mark's not maybe mentioning it in this article. Mm-hmm. That doesn't change the underlying problem, which is that they got to keep making new cards. And as time goes on, more and more of the simple ones will just have already been made. And right. So they have to kind of keep making new mechanics and things like that to address those things. But I do feel like there's been a little bit of a step forward in terms of managing complexity a bit.
Okay, I'll accept.
Maybe that's optimistic of me. We're also a little over a year on from all these sort of changes to how they're approaching the color pie, giving white more card draw. And I mean, importantly, the underlying drive there is printing more cards for Commander, Magic's most popular format. We said at the time that we actually felt like the implementation of this idea, the cards they were printing, were fine and cool and great. And it was actually totally fine that white got card draw or whatever. We did express some concerns about the vision, the like leadership for the product being focused so heavily on like player feedback, especially around a format that was fan invented, you know, not what Magic was originally meant to be, Commander, multiplayer, all that kind of stuff. We did talk about the fact that it was a little bit, maybe worrisome is too strong a word, but a little bit notable that it seemed like they were really taking to heart that, hey, these players that play in this way that we didn't necessarily intend initially when this game was invented want all these new mechanics and we should just give it to them. But overall, we were like, it's actually in practice fine. It's, you know, maybe the pattern is not great. Like, we shouldn't get in the habit of just like giving players whatever they want, and that's not necessarily the way to make the best product. But the actual cards feel okay. Do you still feel that way today?
Yeah, I feel like there has been, well, at least I felt a difference in there was a time period where they were printing, when they really started explicitly printing stuff for Commander in basically every product they made, a lot of rares in standard sets were, rather than feeling like they are, you know, targeted at standard, they were targeted at Commander. And a lot
it's
of those
still
cards
true.
It's still true, but I think they have done a little bit to address like how do these cards intended for multiplayer function in 1v1. And I don't feel as much like every cube draft is like, yep, just take every commander card, because I've done a little bit of a better job of balancing things and making things...
Or maybe all the people that make cubes in our playgroup have cut cards from commander sets.
Could be both.
It's been more of that going on.
I mean, but thinking about just a card that I saw yesterday, this green-red card that lets you tap an artifact to...
I was going
to
specifically mention Maria, Scholar of Antiquities.
Yeah, and that's a great example of a card that, like, that clearly looks like it says, build a commander deck around me, but feel totally...
In retail draft,
just
it looks
busted.
Like where's the artifact theme in this set, and there is none in DMU.
Correct,
it basically
yeah.
is non-functional. All the it's a 3-mana 3/3 in the limited set.
Yeah.
Which I think that I still feel like, and I don't draft retail limited very often, but when I do, it's like, oh, here's a card that I have to like remember. Is this actually something that is supported in this limited format, or is this effectively a trap because it's actually here for commander and it's a legendary card designed to build a commander deck around that is on some theme not covered in this particular format?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely a thing. Which is actually, I mean, to go back to another thing that they've changed, they've started doing a lot more of these like bonus sheets, like things like Strixhaven,
yeah.
things like that. And those, I think, are actually pretty effective. One, I think it feels less weird when it's like, oh, here's this like random card on a bonus sheet. Is this indicating a theme of the set? No, it's like this weird random like hypermythic card that you're only going to see every once in a while. And I think those have actually just played really well.
I think it's context dependent. In March of the Machine specifically, I felt like they were really cool inclusions. Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of people that have remarked that March of the Machine feels kind of a lot like Cube Draft, because
yeah.
the bonus sheet in that set specifically, a lot of really powerful cards that are like cool synergistic build arounds that feel like kind of cube cards. There, I think it worked really well. I do think in other contexts, it's kind of like, this just kind of feels out of place, right? Like a lot of the artifacts in the Brothers War sheet, I think, are just like, this doesn't really do anything in retail limited, or it doesn't really function super well.
Well, I don't know if I agree with that. I think they did a better job of making a lot of those cards pretty playable, and they enabled some like really weird, fun decks. Like the one example I can think of that is like the best example of this is somebody opening Phyrexian Obliterator in a deck that otherwise was not playing any black, but they also had an Elsewhere Flask, and so they were just like, you know what? I'm going to put this Elsewhere Flask in my deck, which makes all your lands any color for one turn and draws you a card, so like pretty low cost of inclusion. But they were just like, yeah, this is my Phyrexian
Obliterator
which
coupon,
is a, you know, busted card that costs black, and that's a thing that like you are not going to get in a normal format, because
that's fun every like, once in yeah. a while. That's fun in retail limited for sure.
So I think like in a way these bonus sheets almost function like I wish mythics did more often, where it's not just like, oh, you open the busted mythic, but it's like, oh, here's something weird that doesn't come up often, but every once in a while I'm going to find a cool way to build around it.
Yeah,
you know, other cards like Wormcoil Engine, maybe not so much.
Yeah, I
was
about to say, yeah. Some of them definitely.
But there's also a rarity to that sheet as well, so I feel like that works out.
Yeah. Yeah, overall, I feel like the design for the Eternal World thing, you know, I think mostly we've just gotten used to it, right? Like, I think we were feeling the transition.
Yeah.
For the most part. I don't think the things that were irking us are any less prevalent or abundant. I think maybe they've gotten a tiny bit better at helping that medicine go down easy for those of us that are not invested commander players, given that that is still the overall driving force of the game, even though it's not mentioned explicitly in this article. They've gotten a little better at, like, you know, making that palatable to the rest of the audience, but still very much present. And I think I just especially noticed that there was a lot of criticism last year that Mark only mentioned Commander Ascendry in the article. And in this year, he doesn't mention it almost at all, like, except for a few offhanded remarks here and there. Like, he does not talk about Commander in this State of Design 2023 article at all, which just feels like, okay, you learned that people don't like to be told over and over again that Commander is the thing you're designing for. It's still true, but we're just not going to tell you, because when we tell you, it makes you really mad.
I mean, to step back and think about sort of the state of the way that we engage the game, of sort of like the cube design community, I think you're probably right that there has been a change there, where people are increasingly, like, this has been the trajectory for years, that people have been moving away from just this idea that Cube is just a collection of the most powerful cards, and it's a much more, like, creative, expressive space. And people are much more willing to both look at these new Commander cards, you know, especially, like, stuff in the pre-cons, and say, this is not for me. Like, I'm going to give this a skeptical eye and think about, does this actually make sense in my Cube? And I think that we maybe just have gone past that transition of, like, knowing how this stuff works and opting into the parts that are, you know, selectively more fun for us.
Yeah, we know from running the surveys that the Commander product always gets less attention from cube designers. And I've heard more and more people actively seeking out design restrictions that just hard exclude any cards that are printed in supplemental product. I know that friend of the show, Alex, has been doing this to his own cube, cutting out any Commander product or the supplemental cards. There's a whole Legacy format that is basically Legacy minus Commander cards. I think it's called Heritage or something, that has been a fan-made format that's popping up a little bit. So it's like you know, some legacy players got tired of every time a new commander set comes out, everyone's playing, you know, Minsk and Boo or whatever the new card is in Legacy. And we're like, no, screw that. We're just going back to when Legacy was just the broken designs from 15 years ago instead of today's broken designs.
I mean, I think Orange is a more subtle way. Like, when they printed the Monarch mechanic, Palace Jailer is, like, this insane powerful card. And I think when that was printed, people were like, yeah, this is a really powerful card. I got to put it in my cube because it's powerful. And now I think people are much more willing to say, like, this is a card that was designed for multiplayer. It functions very well in multiplayer. It does not function the same way in 1v1. And let's think critically, does that play pattern in 1v1 actually make sense for the kind of gameplay experience I'm looking for? And without that sort of just pressure to play the most powerful cards, people are much more willing to say, no, let's leave that in the multiplayer environment. Let's not put it here.
Yeah, and it's interesting to me to see people in competitive constructed format doing that same thing, right?
Yeah.
Like, people that are just like, I want to play Legacy, but I do not want to play against 4th Aeor Lingus or Comet Stellar Pup. So we are just going to go back to this limited legacy card pool. I don't expect that to get a bunch of traction, and as far as I can tell, it hasn't. But it's interesting that people are, like, there's enough people that are out there that it's a thing, that has a name that people are trying to play. So maybe just more evidence that as Magic continues to grow, it's inherently going to get more and more fractured. There's going to be more and more people that are interested in different aspects of the game, and there'll be enough people interested in your little niche that you can still build a little community around it. So, if complexity and design for an eternal world and Commander were the themes of last year's State of Design article, this year the theme is 100% nostalgia. I actually didn't realize till reading this article that basically literally every set last year was a direct callback, both flavorfully and mechanically, to old Magic stuff. Dominar United, which is obviously a callback to Magic's original plane, and Dominar United was basically heavily inspired by Invasion in terms of its mechanics. It brought back Kicker. It returned to five-color matters with Domain, which was a big major theme of Invasion. It was kind of like you took all of the things that R&D knows and has learned about card design in the intervening years and kind of went back and remade Invasion. And I think the set is much better, especially for limited, than Invasion was. You have that. You have the Brothers War, callback to Magic's most intense story, lots of mechanical callbacks, lots of flavorful callbacks. Phyrexia All Be One kind of feels to me like Mirrodin remastered in a lot of ways. Like, you went back to mechanics that existed in Mirrodin, you like made Infect, but way better in terms of its play patterns. All these sets are just kind of returns to old things, which is not to say new stuff wasn't invented along the way, but it seems to me like the game very heavily traded on its nostalgia and its existing goodwill in the last year.
I think this is really interesting and kind of funny to me because I was not playing Magic at the time that these nostalgic things that are being called back to were happening. You know, I started in, like, what, Kaladesh Aether Revolt was when I was really like, this is going to be a hobby. I'm going to spend a lot of time doing this. So this wasn't really a nostalgia thing for me.
Though,
but I think that these sets are so much better in terms of, like, the story and the theme. Like, I just really, really don't actually, it just does, it's not for me, all these sets that are like, let's play into some really specific trope space and say, like, let's do Magic, but Steampunk. Ancient Egypt. Magic, but it's Art
Mafia.
Deco. Art Deco. Like, that just, it feels very thin to me. And so this idea of, like, hey, we're going back to the story that, like, we wrote, we have control over, and has a lot of depth to it because we've been doing it for 30 years and, like, we made a lot of mistakes and there's weird, like, rough edges to it, that is so much more compelling to me. And just the aesthetics of it, just the aesthetics of, we are in this wizarding world of Magic, but there's also this, like, ancient technology buried under the sand, and there's this history of ancient civilizations that in some ways expanded beyond our capabilities. Like, that's exactly the kind of, like, sci-fi space that really excites me. So it's sort of weird to say that, like, in some way Mark seems like he's saying this was more difficult to get people engaged with these kinds of themes and these kinds of sets, but I just, as one data point, find it so much more engaging and appealing.
There's a lot of elements to this, because I agree with you. I also think while you weren't playing during Invasion or whatever, you got invested enough in the game to know all the cards. So
yeah, that's true.
You still get all the callbacks. You still are like, oh, this is clearly a callback to this thing or that thing, because you know the IP really well inside and out just from having done a million Scryfall searches.
When they spoiled Takassia's Amulet, I'm like, that's hilarious. That's such a funny reinterpretation of such a weird mistake, really. Like, they got, like, the wrong art for a card, or just, like, an art description that didn't make sense. And they're kind of just, like, reinterpreting in a way that if you just see, like, oh, here's this robot that's carrying some stuff, that's cool. But if you get that funny callback, it adds a little extra something.
And I agree that I think the original Magic story, which is in some ways, like, in my opinion, it doesn't have anywhere near as strong of an identity, which I think is part of what Mark is responding to. Like, it's much more generic and broad. Like, it covers a lot of things, right? Dominaria is the plane that's, like, has all the other planes inside of it until 10 years into the game or whatever. So, like, what is the identity of Dominaria? It's, like, fantasy and whatever stuff we made up. It doesn't have, like, a tight branded identity the way that Amonkhet or Kaladesh or Strixhaven or Strix New Capenna does. And to your point, I do think that's a strength. The fact that that's where Magic design went initially was the kind of the obvious answer is for a good reason. Like, it makes a lot of sense with what the game is mechanically, right? Like, it's a world with a bunch of wizards. It's broad. It's diverse. It's got a lot of stuff going on. It covers a lot of ground. And I kind of agree that the sets that have more of a, like, strong, digestible identity, they... I mean, I'm sensitive to this because I studied graphic design, but they feel like a branding exercise. It feels like you told somebody to, like, you know, come up with, like, a tight brand for this game.
Which it feels like that because they did.
They did.
they did. A vision push. They did have a vision booklet where they hand out to everybody who's doing artwork like these.
Well, they do that on these other sets too, right? Yeah. But the underlying starting point is much shallower and simpler, right? Mm-hmm. It's more concise. It's like, we're doing Magic, but Art Deco. We're doing Magic, but Ancient Egypt. And I agree that it is more deep, I think, to return to these original planes. I also do think, on the critical side, it is easy to just keep making sequels and remakes, and we see this in all kinds of other industries all the time because it is so much lower risk to do the thing that you know was already reasonably successful. And I do want to couch this, right, with, like, they returned to Kamigawa, and Kamigawa Neon Dynasty was extremely successful, but the original set was not. It was not a particularly well-received set at the time. It was kind of widely panned for its, like, low power level and, like, weird designs and stuff like that. So that doesn't really fit the mold of, like, hey, you're returning to the successful thing and it's, like, easy layup for you. Like, I'm sure it was actually kind of the opposite inside Wizards, where there'd be a lot of convincing of people in power to be like, actually, we can do this right, even though the last time we did this, it didn't go well. But I do feel like I get, like, a little hint of the, like, Marvel Cinematic Universe or whatever here, where it's, like, literally they made nothing, no new IP last year, right? It was just...
I don't know. The reimagining of the Amulet was pretty big.
That's what I'm saying. Like, there was a ton of creative work that was done within each of these contexts, right? In the same way that when they make a new Marvel movie, it's not like they didn't make anything new. They made a whole fucking movie, right? Like, it's a whole... They had to write a whole script and, like, you know, come up with all this stuff. But they're trading so heavily on the existing thing that they know is going to be successful and they know that people like, that it definitely changes the tenor of it, and I think, like, puts a pretty substantial ceiling on the, like, amount of exciting new ground that can be covered, right? Like, no new Marvel movie is going to be avant-garde, challenging, beautiful new art, because it's inherently like a cash grab on an existing IP, and I do feel some of that is happening here. I think it just happens naturally as the thing gets bigger and more successful. As the thing gets bigger and more successful, it gets more risk-averse. And you just are like, hey, we're spending... I mean, how much more money do you think it costs them on their expense sheet to make a set of Magic now than it did 20 years ago?
Oh, my goodness.
Like, factor of 20, 50? Like, it's got to cost so much more money to make a new set now than it did a while ago.
I mean, the first sets were like, we have a printer, and we have four guys that are going to spend 3 months. And...
Certainly, if you go all the way back, but I'm talking, like, let's go back to, like, Invasion, right? The game was successful. They had an R&D team. It wasn't just literally like, well, here's some people that Richard Garfield knows, and we're just going to let
them
make a set.
Here's the Bridge Club.
Right. Even back then, like, I'm sure that they're just, it's a much bigger operation now, right? They're making way more cards for a bigger audience. They're making them in a million different languages. They are, like, the art is so much more in-depth.
They've got the graphic design team, the printing team.
So
the
much.
Packaging team, the creative team.
And, like, we talked about this a lot in our last episode, and it's going to come up again here too, right? Like, the fact that this has to be a profitable operation and it does have ever-increasing costs is going to change the incentives of the people that are making the thing. And I don't expect that we're going to see a bunch of, like, huge risky swings from Magic as the game continues to grow. And I think last year is evidence of it. Like, none of these sets feel like risky swings to me, except maybe, like, Unfinity, kind of. But we can talk about that in a second. And I just wonder how long we can go without... is every new set going to be a callback to a thing that was previously successful, or one of these, like, neat branding exercise sets where it's like we took a totally existing trope and we just, like, mapped it to Magic and are like, playing in that space? Is that all we get now? Or is there going to be new story with like new worlds that are not just...
I don't know.
I don't know.
If only they hadn't spoiled the next 3 years of upcoming sets recently.
I should say too, I don't know.
You're keen to be surprised.
I mean, I didn't follow it.
All right. I have a question for you. We're talking about sort of like, I mean, really, and this is a huge thing that Mark talks about in this article, is so much about the way that they design Magic isn't necessarily just about what are the cards, what do they do, like what kind of new counters are there and how do they label things. It really is about storytelling, and it's about getting people to engage in this product and setting expectations right about what those stories are going to be like. How important to you is the story?
So here's the thing. I will never read the story. I barely read the flavor text. Like, that is not important to me in a, like, literal sense. But I think having paid attention to it comes through in every other aspect of the game that I do care about. Comes through in the uniqueness and how evocative the art is. Comes through in how resonant the mechanics are, right? Like, all of that, I think, is related. Like, to me, the Phyrexians and the Eldrazi, which are still, like, the most inventive bad guys that, like, Magic has ever come up with, like, they're great enemies in so many ways. Like, I love them as evil forces in the game of Magic. I think they're both really, really good. And I think they're both really, really good, largely because some people sat down and talked for a long time about, like, where do these things come from? What are their motivations? You know, how do they function? How do they operate? What's their organizational structure? Like, all the things I will never care about. I'm not going to, like, learn how to read Phyrexian. I don't give a crap. I'm not going to read the Phyrexian stories. I'm not going to, like, learn the, like, lore. But I think that underpins all the designs that I do love, because I do like the Phyrexians, and I like them in the way that I engage with them, which is, like, as a bunch of cards. And I don't think you end up with the Phyrexian cards I like if you don't do that work on the story side.
Yes, I agree with that. All right, I'm going to make a hot take, which I never do, but this is my first one and only one, which is, I think that this thing that works for Marvel movies, which is, you know, it's big, it's bombastic, everything has its own unique style, just doesn't necessarily make as much sense, at least to me, the way I engage with it, in a Magic set. Because you're not sitting there, you're not sitting down and seeing this whole event. And something like March of the Machines, and especially the Aftermath set, didn't really resonate because they're trying to do this big blockbuster thing and have this huge, yeah, like, event happening. And I don't get that when I'm just looking at a couple cards.
Right.
I think, to me, like, the most effective design solution for telling stories in Magic was, like, Antiquities. The fact that they were like, hey, we have this challenge of people are not going to see these in a sequence. They're going to see them in a random order.
Yep.
They're going to see different volumes of them. Some people are just going to see a couple of these cards. Other people are going to see all of them. And then making the story about picking up the pieces of the past and these, like, little objects and artifacts and things that give you hints about the world.
Which is brilliant, because that's
so brilliant.
How you engage,
exactly,
with the cards. Each little card is a little artifact, the same way you could dig up a little piece of a tablet or a piece of a pot, and you have, okay, here's a little tiny picture. You never see the story of history told from beginning to end in a, like, reasonable structure. You see it in little pieces.
Exactly. And I think that's just brilliant. And I feel that in the way that I first got into Magic, when we just literally were opening a couple booster packs and I'm like, ooh, here's this zombie. What's this zombie about? And ooh, here's Jerrod Golgari Lichlord. What's his story? Oh, well, there's these zombies over here. Maybe they can be part of his story. And, like, to me, building my own story, I mean, obviously this is a huge part of why Commander is so compelling, that this was my first Commander deck and I had this sort of, like, Antiquities style experience of, like, putting together these little pieces and building my own story about what this guy is all about and how he builds his army. And I just don't get that same experience from these big event sets in the same way. I'm wondering, am I the outlier that other people
no,
are like,
you're not.
This is the, like, I'm so excited about this huge new thing. And
no.
Okay. Well,
I mean, he says in the article, like, people are like, this feels like a crappy, like, nothing conclusion to this, like, huge arc.
Yeah. Which, I mean, they're faced with so many challenges. A lot of people do not like the Phyrexians, so he's talked in the past about how they just wanted to, like, give people the right amount. Like, let's do it, but let's not overdo it. But the result of that is, yeah, it kind of feels a little flat.
And it's all the same thing, right? Like, the motivations of a large company with, like, high operating costs and the motivations of a company that are, like, driven by customer feedback, right? That are like, hey, some people don't like this thing. I mean, a big part of me is like, make them like it. Like, okay, do it better. Like,
oh yeah, easy.
Like, don't just don't do it. Don't just don't do it. Like, take that as a challenge to like do a better job of it, or like do it differently or something. But instead, it's like always just, well, give them what they like. Don't give them what they don't like. If some people like it, give them just the right amount. Like trying to like scientifically, you know, using market research and analysis, like make art. That's not how you make great art. You don't make art by doing market analysis. That's how you make a successful product.
Which, I mean, that maybe is the issue, is like, this has to be a product, and I would have the most positive experience with a certain way that magic could be made. That might not be the way to sell them. I mean, that might not be a way to sell any product. That might just be a non-functional way to run a business.
Yeah, I guess maybe, so I guess to go back to the story thing, I don't care at all about the narrative arc, and I actually, I'm going to revise what I said. I don't actually think the narrative arc really matters all that much, even for the part of the game I like. The thing that's compelling about good magic design is like the world building. Like, build a world. I don't care what happens. I don't care what like one guy does in the world, right? Because like, I'm a guy in the world. I'll do my own thing in this world. And having that rich depth to that world and helping people get exposed to it in different ways is what makes a set engaging and deep, and what makes the designs resonant. And I think what you're kind of getting at is like trying to tell this clear narrative arc that has like a beginning, a middle, and an end in a set that you just open all the cards at once and look at them. It's so hard. Like, that's what I think is falling flat here, is the idea of like trying to tell a beginning, middle, and end style story, as opposed to just saying like, let's build a compelling world where like a bunch of stuff's happening and you can pay attention to some of it, not pay attention to some of it. Maybe you aren't even aware of some of it because you never open the cards or you never read the lore or whatever, but it's there. It's this like backdrop, this setting, which gives the world depth and meaning.
Yeah. I mean, this is also sort of just a sidetrack, but I've always felt a little bit weird about like proper noun spells, especially spells like instant sorceries, where it's like, I'm trying to build the story myself out of these pieces, and I don't want to be casting Chandra's Pyro Helix. I don't know who that is. That's just like somebody, part of somebody else's story. I just want to be casting Twin Bolt because I'm a wizard and this sounds cool. Unfortunately, I have Chandra's Pyro Helix in my cube because it's like worded slightly better or whatever.
Well, but part of the problem is that like they made all the Twin Bolts. Like, this gets back to like, you got to keep making new cards thing, and to have a character that you have merch for, you've got product around, you're building an identity around this character, of course you want the Twin Bolt to be Chandra's Pyro Helix instead of Twin
Absolutely.
Bolt.
Absolutely. But what I want to say is that I think the Strixhaven Mystical Archive actually changed some of my feelings about that, because they put a lot of these cards that felt like out of place. It's like, oh, here's Tezzeret's Gambit in Strixhaven. Well, Tezzeret's not here, but it just had this like cool new twist on it where it's like, it's not about Tezzeret being here. It's about, here's this like book of old spells, and this one was invented by Tezzeret. Now you can cast this. You don't necessarily know his story, but you now have access to the spell that some great wizard that has this like own story to it created. And that actually is like giving me that same kind of like antiquities level depth to it, where it's like, we're not giving you the whole story. You just know
the
that
bonus
this guy
sheets
is out
do a
there.
Really good job of that antiquities level stuff, where it's like, this card is a different treatment, and it like alludes to a thing that is not present necessarily in this set. I think those are a really good job of like bringing in the depth of the game and the history of the game to a like otherwise, you know, insular or like self-contained set.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that that's a lot. But yeah, I mean, like the parts that appeal to me are just those like little windows into this complex multiverse, not the things that are just trying to be one whole story all at once.
Yeah. I'll be honest, I almost skipped over the entire Unfinity section of this article because I simply do not care. It is not relevant to me at all. But I think it's worth mentioning because I kind of forgot for a second there that they did this crazy like moonshot. Like, the riskiest thing they did all year by far was printing Unfinity with some Eternal legal cards in it and some not, which I still think, if we're taking our, like, this is our one episode a year where we get to just offer some, like, unsolicited criticism, I think that was a huge mistake. I think it's so confusing that some of, I literally forgot that some of the uncards you can just play in Commander and play in Legacy and play in Vintage, and some of them you can't, and now it's not the silver border that matters, it's actually this little symbol, and some have an acorn, and some have the regular whatever. Like, that's just so complicated, and that is also the biggest impact we felt this year of Design for an Eternal World. Like, literally, like, we just want people to buy this product so they can put it in their Commander decks. And we hear from people all the time that if you print a set that's not legal in Commander, why do I give a crap at all? Because everyone cares about Commander. And this was like the biggest kowtowing to that audience and to that like market incentive that I think otherwise has no justification. Like, it removes what's special about the unsets. It removes the clarity of the silver border. It like sacrifices so much for this like market concession of like maybe we'll sell more packs because people can put whatever card in their commander deck.
I played against one attraction commander deck and never again.
Never again.
I don't want to build one myself, and I don't ever want to see that.
And I'll be the grumpy guy. I think having like cards that are legacy relevant in unsets is awful. Comet Stellar Pup is this like high variance but very powerful design that I think is just not fun for legacy. There's also that stupid goblin, everyone calls Mind Goblin. But that's actually like it's a ritual goblin that is actually extremely valid in certain legacy decks. But as far as I'm concerned, I think still is not on Magic Online, which is where the vast majority of the legacy metagame and like competitive play happens. So there's always this like question mark going into like a legacy tournament, like how many people are going to be playing this deck that you can actually only play in paper, and how do I like play against it? Because I practice all the time on Magic Online, and it's got the card Mind Goblin in it. Like, it's so dumb. I don't know. Mark Rosewater has been advocating for a long time for getting more humor into the game, and I think he's been successful overall, not just in Unfinity, but like,
oh yeah,
you know,
for sure.
There's the three porridge card that's coming out in the new Eldraine set, and we got like the little like gingerbread man. Like, we see more comedy in regular cards, and overall I think that's cool. I've been a fan for like, yeah, bring more of that in. Like, Magic does not have to be self-serious. I'm not one of those people, but there is something about these like goofy, stupid cards being up there with the most powerful cards in Vintage and Legacy that's like, this just feels like you've sacrificed something here just to sell some more packs.
I feel very complicated about this. Like, I don't think it was the disaster that you think it was. I think it was a weird move because
I don't think it had that big of an impact, to be clear. I just think it was a big mistake that had a mild impact on things.
I mean, to me, it's just like, I think that, again, they're trying to solve a very real problem, and I empathize with that problem, which is, like, people didn't take the unset seriously, and Mark Rosewater
is
like...
You shouldn't! They're meant to not be taken seriously! I mean, they're the unserious sets!
They're not unserious. They're not unserious from a game design perspective. Like,
they should be!
The message, the, like, what do you want to call it? The thesis, the underlying thing that the unsets were, what if we could do Magic, but we didn't have to make it tournament legal? Like, let's give ourselves the freedom, the flexibility to do different stuff.
That is the underlying thesis.
And this did make that message a lot more...
Yeah, it threw it right out the window.
Very, very confusing.
Yeah, threw it in the garbage.
But I feel like that doesn't mean, like, these are not cards that are untested.
No, I didn't say that
at
all.
They can use that name in the future if they want. but it's like, I think that there is a lot of frustration that I've heard specifically on Drive to Work from Mark Rosewater about, like, how people just don't take this seriously and don't, like, sit down and say, like, take it seriously in the sense of, this is a game, it's meant to be fun, let's sit down and enjoy these cards. People are like, those aren't real Magic cards. And I see this fact that they threw out the whole conceit out the window was them trying to soften that barrier and say, like, yeah, these are fun cards. Please enjoy them as a game. Don't worry about the fact that you can take them or you can't take them to your legacy tournament, because that's not how most people engage with the game anyway. That's how, like, almost no one engages with the game.
Here's what really strikes me about this. We hear so often from Magic and Wizards of the Coast, not everything in the game is for you, right? Like, if some player base complains about X, it's like, okay, well, that's just not for you. That's for a different chunk of players. And I think that's totally reasonable. Magic is diverse. There's a lot of different people playing the game. And it's reasonable to say, hey, you commander players, let's, you know, it cuts the other way too. Hey, you commander players that are mad that there's not enough of whatever in this new set, this is actually a set that we, you know, focused on this other thing, or we really care about the limited experience here for whatever reason. So, yeah, sorry, there's only 100 legends instead of 180 legends or whatever, right? Like, I think it's reasonable. It's a reasonable response to those complaints to say that. It cuts the other way, too. Mark Rosewater does not get to complain that some people don't like his product. Some people do like it. You don't. It's not for everybody, Mark. You shouldn't try to make everything for everybody. So, like, I don't know. I didn't think I felt this strongly about this, but
yeah,
I'm getting riled up. It's like... Because I thought the original unsets were very cool, and I do feel like the idea is just dissolved in the ether now. It's like, what even is an unset anymore? It's just some cards that Wizards of the Coast is selling. And I thought it was very cool to have cards that were, like, unserious. Not in the sense that, like, people shouldn't care about them, but, like, they appealed to a totally different audience, and that was fine. And the idea that we can't make this set unless we can also print a bunch of cards for Commander, in my opinion, then don't make it. Don't make it. If you can't get the brass at Wizards of the Coast to let you make this set, if you're not also going to try and sell a bunch of cards to Commander players, then just don't. Have some artistic integrity and say that's not what this thing is.
I think that kind of sucks, though, to say, like, hey, we have this great idea of, like, what if we want to make Magic, but we're not beholden to thinking about tournament play. If there's no other financial way for them to make that make sense, then, you know, put a bunch of cards that are commander playable in it, then I get it. I get why they want to do that.
I get why they did it, but it made the thing bad. Sorry.
I think what made the thing bad was that it was just too complicated, and mechanics are not things that I want to engage with, specifically stickers and attractions. Whereas I thought contraptions was like very, like a cool amount of novelty and break from normal Magic. I don't know. I mean, I also really empathize with the fact that, like, it's been very frustrating to see that people are, in a lot of ways, really celebrating the, like, Mystery Booster playtest cards, which are absolutely not intended to be real Magic cards in the
same
way.
That's because they have artistic integrity. They're clear.
Dude, they just made them up.
Yes, but they're so, they're, like, the whole point of them is that, like, they are made to not be taken seriously, and that's why people like them. There's no ambiguity. They have an identity. It's clear why they were made, and they were not made to sell packs. They were made because people wanted to make these weird, goofy things. That's why people love them. People can feel the artistic integrity. That's how you make great art.
Artistic integrity, huh?
Yeah, you can feel it. You genuinely can, and that's why people don't like being pandered to. People don't like this idea. People don't like art that is like made to appeal to the lowest common denominator and just sell the most things, right? And like,
people love that. The lowest common denominator sells off the shelves.
That's not what love is, Anthony. That's not what love is.
People love McDonald's.
Some people love McDonald's.
It's not in their tagline, their what do you call it? Their jingle. You can't lie in those.
Yes, you sell a lot of Marvel tickets in terms of people that will like. I mean, maybe Marvel's a bad example because that also has the full history of like all the comic books and people that are like, you know, disgusting Marvel heads. Let's look at Fast and the Furious, right? Like Fast and the Furious will sell a million tickets because a gazillion people are like, this is a dumb, fun thing I can do for an hour on a Friday night. And I will not be challenged intellectually. I will not be surprised in an unpleasant way.
Wow, what a comfortable, like, I'm going to go into this night knowing I'm not going to be challenged intellectually.
I'm just going to go in and like, I'm going to have like a fireworks show like put on for me, right? Like that sells a lot of tickets. A lot of people like it enough to buy a ticket to it. How many people love Fast and the Furious? How many people are going to see the Fast and the Furious movies and say, I want to make movies. I want to make film because these things inspired me.
Well, now they would say I want to make YouTube, but...
You get my point. There's a difference between a popular thing and a good thing. I mean, this is like Art 101, right? Like, the popular thing is not the good thing. And the things that mean the most to people are not the things that sell the most, necessarily. So, like, yes, Mystery Booster playtest card. How much of the Magic audience cares about those? I would argue probably a pretty small margin of people care about them. There's also very few of them in existence. And the people that care about them love them. They're, like, they have a high monetary value because people really want them in their collection. They think they're very cool. That's, like, a perfect example of, like, yeah, it's not for everybody. You made it anyway. And it, like, flies in the face of some other things you've, like, essentially said you care about. But, it has integrity. People are into it because it is, like... clear what it is, it's clear why it exists, and you made it for a good reason. You made Unfinity because you wanted to make another Unset and you wanted to sell cards to Commander players. People can taste that. You can taste it in the water, and it's not good.
Yeah, I mean, I do agree that, like, especially stickers and contraptions feel like they were no longer like, hey, there's stuff we can't do within the normal rules. We are constrained by tournament play, so let's make space for that. It did feel like they were just like,
but weirdly, are sticker cards that are legal in tournament play. Like, that's the thing. It's not even like
It felt like driven by, let's go do something weird, not driven by, we are feeling constrained.
Yeah.
Which is not the same.
Anyway, definitely my least favorite product of the year, which is why I wanted to skip right over it. But,
yeah, here we've done a whole thing. What's funny? So do you remember it was delayed many, many times? Apparently the company that made the glue that was for the stickers went out of business.
That's what I heard. It's pretty amazing.
I mean, you talk about like logistic and supply chains. It's like this big
abstract
thing.
This is why it costs them so much to make a set now, because they have to like do all of that, which is like a huge amount of work. And that also coincided with the pandemic. Like for a million reasons, Unfinity got pushed back a bunch. Oh, yeah, yeah. All right, so... couple of things I want to touch on here. We have to talk about Universes Beyond, and I don't think I have as many strong feelings about this. I think this touches on a lot of the same underlying motivations that like the Marvel Universe stuff touches on, right? Like, it makes sense to me that Magic, when possible, wants to integrate other IPs.
I just hate the phrase intellectual property.
It sucks. It's an awful phrase, but it is that's what it is, right? Like, the idea that you have this other company that owns this other thing, and it's not related to a fantasy trading card game. But there's some mutually beneficial arrangement where you can get the people that are interested in Magic maybe to watch an episode of The Walking Dead, or you can get people that love The Walking Dead maybe to try Magic because they see these characters they love. Like, I understand all the motivations for that, And having now seen Warhammer 40K and the Lord of the Rings set, which are by far the two biggest universes beyond things we've seen so far, I don't feel bad about the future of Universes Beyond as a like part of Magic. I think both those sets were brilliantly designed. Like, you could feel in both those sets that they really cared. I think you can just like tell that they put some of their best, their brightest on it.
Would you say it has artistic integrity?
I think it does. I think it absolutely does. And they gave the people...
I'm going to be asking you this a lot now.
Great.
this is the new long tail.
But they gave the people at Wizards the time and resources they needed to make those sets well. I think because they cared. They had extra stake, extra things invested in it. If you like make a set no one likes and burn your connection with the... I don't know. The
Lord of the Rings Foundation, I think.
The Lord of the Rings
called.
Foundation or, you know, the Warhammer 40K company or whatever, Games Workshop. If you burn those bridges, like, that's a bigger cost than just having a set that flops. So I think you can feel they put a lot of extra work into it. I think it comes out just fine. I have no problem with it. I do think, overall, the more this becomes part of what Magic is, it's going to further push this idea that why do anything new and risky when we can just continue to make partnerships with existing successful IP people love and have that baked in as like a little boost to the success of the product as a baseline. I think that's just going to change the way that new Magic cards are made in a way that overall that an impact might not be great, but I don't have any problem with the actual cards and sets that are coming out. I think they're cool.
Yeah, I don't have strong feelings. I would just say overall they're like not really to my taste. Again, going back to like my experience of the multiverse, if I peek into this little window and I see some cool artifact from that, you know, has this history in the game, that's cool. I peek into a window and I'm like, "Ooh, Spider-Man's in here." Like, that just it just feels weird.
Where
to
does
me.
The web doesn't, come out? It, icky.
It doesn't give me the same like curiosity, I guess.
Yeah, no. It does, I think Wizards has made a calculated decision to say, like, we are going to dilute the value of our brand in exchange for assuming some different kind of value from these other brands. Like, it definitely makes what Magic is much less clear and more ambiguous. And that does make Magic, I think, overall a less valuable IP in big air quotes. Uh-huh.
Those are some spooky quotes. Yeah, I mean, which is fine. I mean, again, they're doing business. And am I going to feel differently when they make the...
Labyrinth?
The Universes Beyond that is, like, directly targeted at me and I get to cast David Bowie's tight pants? maybe. We'll see.
David Bowie's tight pants. What do you think?
I wish I could remember the name of the little squirrel goblin.
It gives the equipped creature Intimidate and it doesn't untap every other untapped set because the pants are too tight.
Sure, that makes sense.
Whenever it attacks, whenever it becomes tapped, to put a stun counter on
it. You got to put a warning that Wizards employees need to stop, let's skip ahead because of the custom card you just designed.
Yeah, it's a beautiful one.
When they make
one.
The Dark Crystal crossover, am I going to be like, this is absolutely amazing? Maybe.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like actually the people these really appeal to are not the really dedicated fans because they're going to be like, oh, you did it wrong. Like, the
maybe.
People that are really into Lord of the Rings are really into... Actually, I didn't hear many complaints of people that are really into Lord of the Rings. Maybe they did do, you know, well by the source material. Maybe we'll see more of that with Doctor Who or whatever. People will be like, oh, this is not what the Doctor is. But people that have seen the show, think it's fun and like it, that maybe have never played Magic, like, that's who it's pointed to. And, like, again, I'm the little parasite attached to the bottom of this shark. I want the shark to keep eating. So, like, yeah, go ahead. Keep finding new Magic players. Like, that's fine by me. It's all good. I don't have a big rant to go on about Universes Beyond. And honestly, do you even know? There was a whole thing on Twitter, like, 2 weeks ago. Where people were all mad about Universes Beyond. But because I'm so good at tailoring my Twitter experience, I only saw people commenting on the people that were mad about Universes Beyond. I didn't actually see any of the actual complaints. What were people mad about? Is it just that, like, there's gonna be Final Fantasy cards now or whatever?
I have no idea. I don't even see that.
Great.
On X.
Oh, God. We've talked about Super Smash Bros. In this show before, and it seems there's a lot of people that like Magic and also like Super Smash Bros. And Super Smash Bros. Is really fascinating to me because this is what it is. Super Smash Bros. Is the Universes Beyond fighting game. They were like,
oh, they're smashing all the games together. Is that what it is?
I don't know if that's... probably. Let's go with that.
Cool.
And I think it's really successful at what it does. It is so cool to get to play as Cloud Strife versus Isabelle. Like, I mean, it's like it's
how
like
do you feel about Spider-Man?
It's like satisfying a fantasy of like video game players that are like, I sure would like to chop up this dog with a big Buster sword. Like it's
oh that old fantasy.
Like, I mean, it's like when people sit around. And it's like, you know,
who would win in a fight, Spider-Man or
exactly
a horse with a sword?
Teens sitting around saying it's BoJack Horseman versus Jake the dog. Who wins in the fight?
Well, those are
Jake,
from the same.
Clearly.
Oh, Jake the dog, not Mr. That just pictured.
Not Mr.
I just
Peanut Butter.
Mr.
Jake
Peanut
the dog
Butter.
From Adventure Time.
Jake the dog,
he's
voiced
magical.
By Paul F. Tompkins.
No, it's Mr. Peanut Butter.
I know, but we're mashing it up.
Anyway, I think that Super Smash Bros. Does this really successfully, and when I'm trying to like talk myself into Universes Beyond for Magic, I try and be like, let's just let Magic be the Universes Beyond for fantasy IP and like trading card games or whatever. And here's why it doesn't work quite as well. It's worth noting, like, Super Smash Brothers started, and that was the idea. The very first version of Super Smash Brothers had characters from all over different Nintendo games. It did take them one or two games before they started really integrating stuff from like totally different companies, but it was all characters from different games all together fighting each other. And so that was how it started. And there was no, I mean, there is a little bit of like Super Smash Brothers lore with like the Master Hand and Gleam and all that kind of crap. Just like Magic, I don't care about the lore of Super Smash Bros. Either, but it is fundamentally about bringing together all these unrelated things. And Magic was not, right? For 30 years, Magic was not about that at all. It was its own world. And I think a lot of the friction we feel is trying to introduce Spider-Man into Dominaria is inherently tense.
The scene was awkward.
It was weird. So I don't know. I'm always thinking of that precedent. It is different, but there's also this weird connection. I think we've said this before, that like the DLC packs in Super Smash Bros., which I know you know nothing about or don't care about, but like they make the game, then they make additional characters for the game later, and those characters you have to pay money for. And they have to sell those characters, Anthony, and so they tend to be just a little bit better than all the other characters, because otherwise, why would you buy them? So there's always this kind of like perennial complaining in every Super Smash Bros. Game about the bullshit DLC.
We find Steve annoying.
Yes, Steve in particular, for other reasons as well. That feels to me a lot like the Modern Horizons sets or the Power Creep in Magic, or like, you know, just printing these like Commander products where like all the cards are just a little bit better for the exact same like underlying, you know, market incentives or whatever. There's always interesting connections there. Anyway, one last thing I think is worth noting. I think one of the biggest things about Magic recently has been the One Ring. And the fact that they printed this one card and then Post Malone bought it for $2 million or whatever. Like, this is thing that I've had, like, my relatives and friends that don't play Magic have been sending me, like, look at this thing that happened. And I'm like, yeah, I'm well aware. In some ways, that is, like, what the villain would do in a movie where you were trying to, like, make a poetic statement about how the company had totally sold out. They just, like, printed. Like, I was telling Harley the other day, it's so silly to me that this card is worth, in the world's biggest air quotes, $2 million, because they just printed it.
They just
like,
made it. They can just make as many as they want.
And yes, they like they just printed all the cards in alpha too, but like at this point, those are historical artifacts. They can't print new alpha cards and have them be worth as much, because this is a like thing from history that was the foundations of this game that now is this huge thing. So that's why those cards are valuable. There is some like actual, I mean, not actual value, but there's a more deep
There's a better story.
There's a more deep justification for the value of those cards versus, like, literally, we made this one shiny card, and so there's only one. Go fight each other like wolves over it and see who gets it. But I'm glad Post Malone got it instead of some crypto bro or whatever.
You know, I mean, if we're doing just not the state of Magic as a company and as a business, but the state of, you know, our relationship to Magic, for me, the most optimistic part has just been, like, in the past, I've been interested in Limited, interested in Commander, interested in cube design. The last year, I've been much more interested in like building a community.
Done a great job of it.
Building tools and like making cool spreadsheets for rotisserie drafts, like all this kind of stuff. And I'm always interested in not just the one thing, but the way that things interface and connect with each other. And the fact that, you know, my interest in Magic overlaps with, you know, my skills as a computer programmer and, I don't know, the just like meeting cool people. All that.
We have a great community here. We had somebody come out last night to play with some of us that almost never comes out, and they were like, it's a cool group of people. It's like, there's not a bunch of, I mean, people are so used to a certain type of person that...
What type of person?
What type of guy would you say I am? If you had to guess, just what type of guy am I? And for the most part, we just have such a great community here, and largely due to all your efforts. So yeah, that's definitely the bright point of the past year for me too. Yeah, I don't know. What else? How do we end the episode?
I don't know. How do we usually do it? I usually know. Just like...
You gotta go.
I gotta go.
You gotta go. And on that bombshell, thanks for tuning into this episode of Lucky Paper Radio. All of our music is produced by DJ James Nasty. All the magic cards, the ones we love and the ones we don't, are produced by Wizards of the Coast. This podcast is produced by thinking really hard about magic cards and speaking into microphones about it. Thanks again, Anthony.
Thank you, Andy. You're gonna make Aaron mad again.
I did it, didn't I? On the previous episode?
Oh, did you? Oh, I just forgot.
I think I did it on the previous episode. Or maybe I didn't.
I don't think you did.
Oh, no.
No.